This is After the Credits, the home of correct movie opinions since 2007.
Yeah.
Welcome to episode 353 of After the Credits. I am one of your co-hosts, Rain Antunes, joined today by fellow co-hosts.
Steve Stebbing.
And Melissa McDowell.
We are billless today. We're going to forge ahead and talk some movies. But before we talk some movies.
Our shit's not going to be definitive because Bill's not here.
No, it won't be. Cool. I'm going to do something that might actually bother him. when he listens back to this one, I don't know how he lands on this one, but I just know how he usually lands on films like this. So he might come back with some fire on me next time.
Oh,
we'll get there. Okay.
Defenseless and shots fired. Look at this. Yeah. It's going to be an exciting show.
Already. Yeah.
Well, considering that we started our preamble with sports talk.
Yeah, it's almost like Bill was here for a second.
In spirit.
He'd be proud.
Probably. But before we talk about new stuff that we've seen, Melissa, maybe we should talk just briefly, because I don't want to dwell on it too much, but I think we should briefly discuss the 13-hour horror movie marathon that we partook in on Halloween night at the Cinematheque in lovely Vancouver.
Yeah.
I saw the list of films in there, and there's a couple in there that I've never seen in theaters before. So, I'm definitely jealous. It was nice of Bill to be like, well, I'm there in spirit. So I felt that. I wish I was there, guys, for sure.
Well, Bill surprised us. I got a text from him when we were like lined up waiting to get in. And he was like, so what time are you guys heading down to the Cinematheque? And I was like, what a weird question. Like, we're here already. And then he showed up like shortly thereafter.
Oh, that's crazy. So
Dan turned around and he's like, who's that? Who's that coming? And we all looked. I'm like, hey, it's Bill.
He just ducked out before the fog, which was the finisher.
To be fair, before the marathon, he caught Frankenstein at VIFF before he came to his
Cinematheque.
Nothing says like prepping for a 13-hour movie marathon like watching a movie before.
And especially a two and a half hour movie. Yeah. But it's all about that 35mm, right?
Yeah. But it was fun.
It's Bill. He's got a flex, right? Like, yep. You're going to do 13 hours? I'm going to do 15 and a half.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
It was fun. It was a really fun night for the most part. I can't say I liked all of the selections, but overall, it was a really good time.
I'm so jealous you guys got to see Wreck on a theater screen.
And I think half the audience hadn't seen it, which was even more fun.
So there was like because the body dropped through the.
I realized that half the audience had not seen it before.
The audio, everything. Because I mean, I saw that one when I was when I was working for Rogers Video. And I was the one that would receive all the movies in on the Tuesday before they'd come out next week. So I remember like, oh, I'm taking this one home. And I closed the store that night. And it was like just past 11. So I didn't start it till like 11:30, 12. And just, you know, chain smoking doobie after doobie and just getting so paranoid with that movie because it's so brilliantly well done. And that third act is insane. It's still a marvel of how they made that film.
And it still so plays. Good. It still kills. It plays really, really well.
I was super jealous of the people in the theater who hadn't seen it before.
No doubt.
Like it's great on a rewatch, but like the first time watch of that film is like everything it's about scary. It is so shocking and so like visceral and probably the best, like, because it plays like found footage.
It
feels really real and pretty terrifying. So I mean it's still great on a rewatch, but Agreed. Nothing beats the first time.
Nope.
But the timing of the placement of that, those, because I thought that block started with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and we needed a pick me up because it had been some draggy movies up until
there are some slowish ghosty type stories. So yeah, we like, and it was like the halfway point to the marathon, so we needed to jazz it up with some gore. So Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Rec fully delivered on that score.
I fully That's agree.
Awesome.
Yeah. That's
for me, that cool. was definitely the highlight. Actually, I'd never seen The Innocents, so that it was really great to see that on the big screen as well.
I for me, like, I love Martin. Martin's like one of my favorite movies Hell of all yes. time. Yeah. And I think it's like one of the most innovative vampire movies ever made. And I'm amazed like no one's really ripped it off, you know?
I think it's one of Romero's best films he's ever done,
yeah.
to be honest. I am a huge fan of Martin. My buddy Matt showed it to me when I was in high school. And I was like, why doesn't anybody talk about this film when it comes to Romero? It's always Night of the Living Dead or yeah. like even the deep cuts are like Creepshow and stuff. And you're like, no one ever talks about Martin. Martin's such a wild film.
Yeah. And it's like the thing that really hit me, because I've seen it before, but I've never seen it on the big screen. And I like really appreciated the cinematography watching it this time. There's just some really great shots in that film.
Any shot with blood in that film is so well done.
Like, yeah.
I really
do. And that's, and then like baby Tom Savini.
Yeah.
Like he's so young in that movie. He's like, yeah. I mean, the guy, like, okay, he's had a bit of work done. He still looks like really good for how old he is.
Yeah.
I met him at a con like a few years ago and I got him to sign like a zombie t-shirt for me. And he's like, he's a super lovely person.
Yeah.
And yeah, just, I like his whole backstory is crazy though. Like he got into FX because he was in Vietnam.
Yeah.
He was like reproducing. So he knew how to reproduce gore that looked real. Which is sort of terrifying, but
very much so.
Also like a really interesting way to process a lot of trauma, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm sure you still need therapy.
Yes.
But.
Yes. Yes, I'm sure you do. But yeah, so that was also a big highlight for me. Cause I just, nice. I love Martin and I was like absolutely not expecting to see it that night on Halloween. And it was so great to see that one. The Innocence was also really interesting. I kind of wish that I had seen it before seeing the Flanagan's Bly Manor, I think. Because it is the same story, but Flanagan is told of quite a different version of it with a different ending. So that kind of tripped me up a little bit. And then also, like, I thought Birth was the first really uncomfortable kiss between an adult woman and a child. And this one beat it by like over 40 years. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And not just once.
Yeah, it was very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Oh, very uncomfortable. Speaking of Birth, coming to Criterion Collection Blu-ray.
I know.
Ooh,
I was telling Melissa my next Criterion order is going to be very Nicole Kidman heavy.
Do you have others?
No, the others isn't even the one that I want. It's to Die For, Birth,
Van Sant,
and Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh, right. I really love that Eyes Wide Shut cover too. I like how kind of punky it is.
I fucking love that movie. I love that movie when I walked out of the theater the first time I saw it, and I still love that movie.
Yeah, my date hated me for bringing them to that movie.
Dan still refuses to watch it for that exact same reason.
Yeah.
He fucking hated it.
I was. They were not a fan of me for a while. And I'm like star eyes, like,
oh my
what
God.
Do you mean you hated it?
Yeah.
I want to go see it again.
Yeah, right.
I guess that's how you knew she wasn't the one, hey?
Yeah. Right. Well, it's actually Chloe's mom, so. Oh, so no, it didn't work out.
Oh my goodness, that's funny. So yeah, 13-hour movie marathon survived, and hopefully we can do it again at some point.
Oh, and yeah, just like big shout outs and thanks to the Cinema Tech and to Sean for like putting together such a cool program. They haven't done a marathon since before COVID. Like, we were trying to remember like the year of the last 24-hour marathon, and I think it might have been like 2018, maybe 2018 or 2017, somewhere in there. I feel like, because it was before COVID for sure.
And
it was really fun, and it was like really fun because the only people that do this are like hardcore cinephiles and movie lovers, right? And so it's like really something special to be in a theater with like a whole bunch of other giant movie nerds too. Like, it's just like, that's just really lovely because you could definitely have like cool conversations with people in the lobby or even in the bathroom or whatever, like in between shows and stuff. So yeah, it was a really lovely thing. I hope they do more of those. And the 13-hour format I think was really smart because, like, although it kind of felt weirdly more daunting than the 24-hour, because the 24-hour at least like starts in the morning and then ends in the morning. And this starting at 8 o'clock, it was like, whoa, it starts at 8 o'clock. It's going all night. I don't know. But it makes a lot of sense because there's like Vancouver doesn't charge for parking overnight on the meter spots. So I don't know if that was like a factor or what, but I don't know. Anyway, I hope they do more marathons. It was really fun. It was great not knowing what was coming too. Yay Cinema Tech.
Yeah, we had a really good time. Dan was very concerned about the movie selection. And even though he didn't love all the movies, he still had a really good time. And Dan is he's my measuring point. If he's okay, then it was fine.
I think he's the benchmark for the podcast, isn't he? Did Dan like it? That's always the question. Did Dan like it? He did.
I think Craig's gonna have to become the benchmark because Dan is now, we've been together so long at this point that I've rubbed off on him, because 10 or 15 years ago he would not have done the marathon. Like, I would have mentioned that he would have like looked the other way and gone, no, you're going by yourself. He's softened up a little over the years. So
Marina, I love Craig dearly, but he can't be the benchmark, or our whole podcast is going to be like Naked Gun and Happy Gilmore 2. And it's no.
All right. Okay, so now that Halloween and this marathon is behind us, let's talk about some new-ish and newer releases. Where should we start? Should we start with Frankenstein? I don't want to delve too deep into Frankenstein because, Melissa, I know you haven't seen it.
Yeah, I can be light. I can be kind of light on it.
It's okay. I don't think you could spoil something where the story's been out since the 1800s.
Yeah. So. I was going to say, spoilers are probably not a concern here.
No. I mean, a lot of it's just in look and execution. But yeah. I obviously, you know that Guillermo's the perfect person to do this film. And honestly, it's probably like one of my favorite adaptations of this story. I like this one, and I really like the Brana version from the 90s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I really, really love the middle part of this film. I love Jacob Elordi's part of this film. I think he really arrived as an actor for me in this film. Through all the prosthetics and all the makeup and everything, the humanity that he gives Frankenstein's monster is incredible. I think it eclipses everybody else in this film. And the stuff that him and David Bradley have together is really where the film comes alive for me. But just the look, the scope, everything's incredible. I mean, the opening with the ship and everything, the ship stuck in the frozen ice and stuff. There's just so much incredible stuff. All of Guillermo's violence has a subtlety to it that's really cool to see as well, while being just brutal as well. Like, so many just brutal things. But he handles everything with such an elegance. There's nothing like Guillermo del Toro's filmmaking. He's our goth daddy. And yes. I love him for it. I really love him for it. This movie just comes together in every way. Oscar Isaac just chewing the scenery as this egotistical, just fucking dickhead. It's just, you know, driven and brilliant in his own ways.
But also really human. I think one of the things that I love about this story is that it's about these very flawed people at the end of the day. Everybody, no one in this movie is, you know, completely without fault. It's really human. And I fully agree with you. I think Gilordi is like nothing short of brilliant. The fact that he manages to have that much emotion shine through so much makeup, like just the amount of makeup on him, and the fact that he still manages to give a really subtle performance is like shocking. And his physicality is fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like really fantastic.
Yeah. I really dug him. I think technically this film should get a lot of attention. It is a marvel, and it is so beautifully done and so many incredible shots. There's those sun-kissed shots towards the end of the film that are across the ice that are just like, holy fuck, they're so hopeful looking, and which is so odd to see kind of in a Guillermo film. Also a little bit of MVP to Christoph Waltz as well, who's really great in this film. Really dig him. This is kind of one of those big films that more people should check out in theaters than on Netflix, because it's so worth the theaters.
Yeah, I think
I'm glad Netflix, I got it here in Penticton. I was so surprised. So,
well, yeah, it's not often that Netflix actually goes ahead and opens a film wider than their usual like theatrical run, because they generally around this time of year, they will run their films for at least a week at a local art house. But the fact that they've seen that this has legs and have managed to open it wider is great. Gets more people to see it on the big screen. And it really does need to be seen on the big screen. I mean, it doesn't have to be, but I think it plays really well on the big screen. Yeah. It's just so beautiful.
Yeah.
So beautiful.
Well, and those sets, everything's so authentic about this film. Like that ship and Victor's like lab are all completely authentic, and like
it's pretty amazing. Yeah. So we went to see Dennis Berardi, who was the VFX supervisor on the movie, during VIFF, talking about the making of the film, and he walked us through a bunch of images and some of the behind the scenes, and one of them was the ship, which they actually built in the back parking lot of the studio. So he showed pictures of the studio with this giant ship, but part of it like sitting literally in the back lot. So it opens with like the description on the movie is like Northern Sea, whatever the year is. And I turned to Dan, we looked at each other, I'm like, parking lot, Toronto.
Yeah, right.
it was just a funny thing. But yeah, there's it's like I was the sets and the costumes, like all of his movies always look amazing, but holy fuck, the costume design is like on another level. I was like salivating, like literally that scene where the father drives up. Oh, who is it? I can't even remember the name of the actor. But the mother is like standing at the steps with this red dress that's just like flowing everywhere. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh my God, could we just like frame this shot for just a moment? Need this.
The caskets. The caskets. Yeah, oh. With the fucking, the faceplate and stuff.
Oh, so like, beautiful.
Whoa. Yeah. Yeah.
This movie is so pretty, Melissa. Oh my God, it's so pretty. Yeah, it's so pretty, and this the amazing gothic touches. It's just on another level. But no, we thoroughly enjoyed it. Dan looked at me. He's like, I think I love that movie. I'm like, no, I love that movie. Go away. You can't both love the same thing. And then I'm like, I hope this thing ends up on Criterion, because I am buying that so fucking fast.
Well, I mean, if Pinocchio made it to Criterion, then I'd say Frankenstein has a pretty good chance. Oh,
I fucking hope so. Or I don't even need a Criterion disc. I need like a beautiful 4K with all of the behind the scenes, because I want to see all the things.
Yeah. 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 I agree.
It's lovely. I say see it. And I'm still worried for Guillermo's well-being, because I wonder whatever happened with his dad, because that is a fraught relationship if I've ever seen one on screen.
No doubt. Yikes.
Yeah, no kidding, eh? So for those that don't get a chance to see Frankenstein on the big screen, it's available to stream on Netflix November 7th. So
yeah. Yeah.
Very soon, the whole world will get to see it.
Yeah.
Which is also kind of exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I had a chance to see, I'm not sure if you guys have seen A House of Dynamite.
No, not yet. It's still on my list.
Okay, so I'll quickly go through my list. I don't have very many titles either, but we also watched House of Dynamite literally the moment that it dropped. I love Kathryn Bigelow. I cannot help myself. Mm-hmm. I know Bill was not a big fan of this movie. I thought it was really good for the most part. I do have some problems with the decision that they make on how to tell this story, because it literally covers like 18 minutes of time between when they detect the missile coming through American airspace to when it maybe hits. Like, we don't actually know. And it's basically told through a number of different perspectives. So you see the same thing playing out from different angles. It has, that works in some respects and it doesn't work in others, but holy fuck, Tracy Letts chewing scenery. There is nothing greater in this universe than Tracy Letts just like yammering. He is just so fucking good at it. There is a great article that Netflix sent as part of their Tudum newsletter where they talked to one of the technical directors on the film, because Bigelow over the last few years, all of her films have been like very, very heavy on, you know, being realistic. So she always has a ton of technical directors, and they had one of the technical directors talking about some of the, he worked in the Pentagon, and he was, you know, talking about how he talked to some of the actors about how some of these people would interact and the conversations that would happen before you're actually like on screen. And he's like, I didn't need to like tell Tracy Letts anything. I just basically told him, you're the boss, you're in charge. And he just went with it. I'm like, yeah, it comes through. He plays douchebag really well.
That's so funny.
I thoroughly enjoyed this. I thought it was really good. The ending is a little bit frustrating, but I understand why it was decided to be this way. Fred Kaplan, who is a journalist and longtime journalist and author on war, for I think it's Slate, he wrote this like 1,500 word essay on why this is one of the scariest movies he's seen this year. Totally worth a read. I'll link to it. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really good.
Nice.
Really intense. Really great watch. And it really gets at the human element of war and how it doesn't matter. You can prepare for anything and you might think you know how things are going to go, but you can never trust the human element because we're human. Mm-hmm. And regardless of how many times you've trained for something, that's not necessarily how it's going to be on when you're caught in that moment. Mm. Solid filmmaking. Awards worthy? I don't know. Probably not, but still definitely worth a watch. I watched Good Boy.
Nice. With I have Indy, a screener for it.
The best dog actor of the year. It's a great concept. I'm not sure I was quite on board with it as much as I had hoped, but that fucking dog is really remarkable. Like, really, really remarkable. Like, really nice. Impressive. It's a cool concept. The dog can see ghosts, I think. I say because I'm not even sure what I saw. But the dog is cool. And the movie kept me interested for a while. It's very short. It's like 70 minutes or something. It's like a short story that was extended a little too far, but it still kind of works. The Long Walk, didn't love it.
Oh,
I'm sorry. I think
it's the Cooper first bad Hoffman, review I've heard.
Well, no, I mean, it's not, I wouldn't even say it's a bad review. There's we watched it. I can't say I really enjoyed it because I really didn't. I was really bored by like big sections of it, but Cooper Hoffman and David Johnson have really, like, they're really, really great together, and their chemistry is really the only thing that kept me going for the entire movie. I it's fine. I understand the drama. I just, it's too long for that concept. I just don't feel that it, and I'm clearly in the minority. I don't feel like the story really, like, I don't think it sustains the running time.
I'm now feeling a little less anxiety about pissing Belle off because I think you just did it. So I think we're good.
I don't know. I didn't love the Long Walk. It was fine. Fine.
I'm kidding, but not kidding.
Yeah, well, I loved Splitsville, so I made it up with Splitsville, which yes. I think is fantastic. Like, I love this movie so much.
Like, I contended it was like one of the funniest movies of the year. It's still like probably number two.
Wait, what's your number one funniest
Nirvana.
Movie? Nirvana. Oh, okay, which I haven't seen.
Yeah.
Because I felt the same thing. This movie's from the get-go is so fucking funny.
That initial fight scene too between them.
Oh my god, it's
hysterical.
So good.
And the grabbing of the knives is so funny. And
It's so funny. So unexpectedly funny. Like, you just mm-hmm. do not. And that whole car scene, and then with the minivan, and you're like, what the fuck is happening?
All right. Yeah, it's wild. It's totally wild to have like a fatal car accident to set up comedy. It's like, what in what world? And like little MVP moments, like Nicholas Braun coming in as the other boyfriend, the illusionist boyfriend.
All of the boyfriends, like that whole parade of boyfriends, it's got to be the funniest thing ever. We have movie nights on Tuesdays or whatever.
Of course you do.
She just can't get the boyfriends to leave.
No.
It's just, it is so funny. And at the same time, so touching and real.
Yeah. Yeah.
How does Dakota Johnson do it? How does she actually do it?
I don't understand this year run that she's had, especially after having such a terrible one last year.
I'm telling you, it's because she's a genius.
I guess so.
She's like, fuck you, Hollywood.
Those two movies, The Materialists and Splitsville, have won me over to Dakota Johnson
because I
never really liked her before.
No.
She's wonderful. I love her.
You're the poster child for modern dating.
Like, yeah. I mean, the only thing I had previous to this that I could really go on where she played a more significant role than like Social Network or something was that Cha-Cha Real Smooth. I thought she was really great.
Which I still haven't seen. Oh my God.
It's so good.
I need to fix that.
It's really, really, really good.
Yeah. And I avoided seeing that because she's in it.
Yeah. But I think it's very much, I think this may reverse people's feelings and get them to check out some of her older work. But yeah, I do understand the trepidation.
Except Madam Web.
Can I say the 50 Shades trilogy is not good?
I'm never going to do that. No. I'm never going to do those movies ever.
Okay, the first one is okay. The rest of them are really terrible.
Who did?
I mean, Jamie Dornan is really hot, but even he couldn't save that. Nah, that could save that for me.
You are completely 100% on point. Jamie Dornan is really fucking hot.
Was it Catherine Hardwick that did that?
No.
Sam
Taylor Johnson, and then it was like
and
James
then they
Foley.
Pulled the Twilight
and then they
bullshit.
Catherine Hardwicked her and they replaced her.
The fact that we can say, like, we can turn Catherine Hardwick into a verb is really fucking sad.
And it was the same studio.
Yes.
Yeah.
They
didn't learn.
Same studio.
And based on the same IP.
Yeah. Essentially.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is.
That's so, Twilight fanfic.
Yeah.
That's so creepily depressing.
Yep.
Oh my God.
Hooray for women in Hollywood.
Oh my God.
So far.
All right. Right.
So yeah, Splitsville, two thumbs up enthusiastically. Really, really fucking funny. Like,
good.
So funny.
Yes.
So funny.
That's a good one.
And Sorry Baby, complete opposite. I fucking cried. Yeah. So fucking sad. And
Even
also
Victor
really real.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That movie is so good. Like, I love how slow it is, how deliberate it is, how kind of messy it is,
mm-hmm.
how it doesn't, it's not like, she's not interested or they're not interested in telling a story that is like you can fit into a box because that's not real mm-hmm. life. And I just appreciate that so much.
Eva Victor, yeah, that movie's brilliant. It's so brilliant.
It really, really is. Fantastic film.
Everything. The handling of the sexual assault in it. I love the dialogue between her and Lucas Hedges so much. There's so many points in that. And the one scene with her and John Carroll Lynch with the sandwich. So fucking great.
There's so many great
movies. So good. And Eva Victor has got a big, big career. I listened to an A24 podcast with her and Celine Song. And it was so sweet to hear those two collaborators talk about being creative and how unanxious and free that they feel on the sets of their films and stuff. And really endeared me a lot more to them. And I love Eva Victor a lot. The Sorry Baby is one of the best movies of the year for me, for sure.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that was my mid-year number one. So
I hadn't seen it yet by that point. Yeah. So.
And that's all I've seen. So I've had I've seen other things, but that's all I want to talk about. So I've had a good run.
Sounds like it. Sounds like it.
Yeah. Yep. Who wants to go next?
I can roll next if you want.
Go for it, Steve.
All right, so this is the one that I thought Bill would be pissy about because I know how he stands on the genre of these films, but Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, I really dug it. I really dug it because it's not, you know, the Birth to Now boss story. It's not a biopic in the full length. It is, feels like a film about him coming to terms with his darkness while also creating something that he didn't really understand was his darkness coming out. And secondarily, it feels like a writing process film. And I really kind of dug that. I'm not really well versed on Bruce Springsteen, but I only fleetingly knew that that he had songs on it about like Charles Starkweather and stuff, but he was so directly affected by Badlands, the film making this record. I thought that was really fascinating. Jeremy Allen White shows you right away that he's like wearing the boss's skin quite well. The mannerisms, the voice, the little ticks to Springsteen speak, how he speaks and everything. He sings in the film and plays the harmonica as well. And I thought that was pretty cool. And Jeremy Strong, as John Lando, which is like his manager, the guy that basically does everything for Bruce, but loves him. They love each other like a brother and you can really feel that connection. So the Jeremys both nail it. I also really like Odessa Young a lot. When she pops up in films and she's in this one and Stephen Graham, just that man is just character actor gold every time. And I also feel like I'm seeing Gabby Hoffman like everywhere now. And she pops up in this one. So between this and the last one being the third act of The Mastermind, I think was the last thing I saw her in. It's good to see Gabby Hoffman, but I really dug this one. And, I know it's a biopic, so it's, one
already
one
quarter of us down.
Yeah, exactly. So it's no Complete Unknown. I think Complete Unknown is a better film, but I really enjoyed what Springsteen was trying to say. Canadian kind of found footagey, released under the Eli Roth Presents moniker, but Dream Eater, this film about a guy and his girlfriend going up to like a cabin to do a sleep study, which goes wrong, and he gets like possessed in his sleep. And this movie is completely unsettling and totally unnerving. It's a film that I, you know, watched in complete the pitch black and turned up the sound. And it a couple points maybe almost had me jumping out of my skin. Like it was pretty insane. And I'm still baffled to what a few of these shots in the third act, seeing how a crew of eight did this film in 9 days. I'm a little blown away by that. So really, really dug Dream Eater. Saw a film called Anniversary. Solid cast to this film. Diane Lane, Kyle Chandler, Zoe Dutch, Phoebe Denver, Dylan O'Brien, and Daryl McCormick, because I haven't seen Wake Up Dead Man yet, so I don't really know Daryl McCormick yet, so this is kind of my introduction to him as an actor. But basically, this is about a rich family in a political climate that's very similar to the one we're in right now. There is another side called The Change that as this film progresses, slowly gains more and more ground to taking over neighborhoods and everything and kind of ripping this rich family apart. The reviews on this one aren't very good, but I really kind of dug this film. It made me gasp a few times in some of the revelations, and I like Diane Lane. I usually like her. Kyle Chandler is a guy that I can watch in basically almost anything, and I dug the parallels that this film was where it was trying to show, and it's done by a filmmaker named Jan Komasa, who did a film I want to say about 5 years ago called Corpus Christi that I really, really dug, and like a very, very interesting story about a juvenile delinquent that he plays a bit of identity takeover in a small town, and it's a really, really well done film. I don't think a lot of people are going to be talking about Anniversary till it hits like streaming or something like that. But the parallels are so hard to ignore. Let's see what else. So I drove into Kelowna yesterday by myself. If I was going to go with my wife, we were going to see Begonia, but I went by myself because she didn't want to go to Kelowna. So I ended up watching Shelby Oaks, Chris Stuckman's film. And in a theater by myself, which is really actually great, because there was a couple moments in this film that I loudly went, holy fuck. So, yeah, there's a couple really good scare moments in it. Stuckman really brings the atmosphere in this one. Like, it feels like it's like chilling you to the bone for a lot of it. The opening, I would say the opening 35, 40 minutes are super unnerving, like really well done when they're going through the initial story to how we get here. Because essentially this is Camille Sullivan looking for her sister who did this paranormal YouTube show who went missing. And I don't know if it fully sticks that third act landing. Like I feel like maybe I wanted a little bit more. And it goes down a slightly familiar path. I don't want to give too much away. But I really like Camille Sullivan a lot, and give him props to Canadian. And for Stuckman to make this film, going from a YouTuber, like a YouTube film reviewer, to making a neon-released horror film, is very inspiring. I have to say that. Like, it definitely gets your wheels turning. I enjoy what this film represents for sure. And finally, I actually finished it a couple hours before this podcast. I watched a film that's actually out on Friday called Nuremberg. This one has Michael Shannon, Rami Malek, Russell Crowe, and this one is about the Nuremberg trial. It was written and directed by James Vanderbilt, who sadly largely probably gets the mud slung at him for writing both the Amazing Spider-Man movies and Independence Day Resurgence, as well as other shit films for Roland Emmerich, like White House Down. But we also have to remember that he wrote Zodiac. So he does have some solid script writing within him. And I think that's where Nuremberg really shines. The script is really great. It's also, it gives you some of the ways the lines are delivered, it's almost chuckle-worthy. Like, it's got just such great banter, maybe a little towards the Sorkin side of the sarcastic, sardonic nature. And they really play up on character. So Michael Shannon does a lot of scenery eating, and as for a guy that's really hit or miss with me, Rami Malek really delivers in this film. I really dug him, and even with another accent, trying to do another accent, Russell Crowe is actually very solid in this film as well. I came through the other side of a 2.5 hour film that Nuremberg is, really digging it. I will say the front half is far more heavy loaded than the back half, but I really dug it.
I was really surprised to see the positive reviews around this one, only because one, subject matter, and two, like, the trailer was not very good. It looks like
super formula.
Yeah, it looks like a very one of these like super like where did they find the money to make this thing? Like who owes who a back scratch? Because like sometimes these movies, they come out and they have these great casts and you're like, how did this ever get made? But when I started seeing the reviews, I was like, maybe this is an anomaly. So
for every movie that has a terrible trailer and turns out to be shit, like of a period piece film, I'm looking at you, Alto Knights. There is a film that has a shit trailer and actually turns out to be somewhat decent, and that's Nuremberg for sure.
What do you think the angle is on this movie?
That's
though?
The other thing.
This like, is the angle on this film. Without getting too deep into the milk, the meat and potatoes of it, is that evil isn't just focused to be found in like the Nazis that perpetrated it, but can be found in anybody else. A monster can be created out of any man, essentially. So that's kind of more of what the focus is of this film, because Rami Malek's character forms, I wouldn't say like a friendship, but he's the doctor to Goring and the rest of these guys, these 21 war criminals in Nuremberg. So his relationship with them is not a prosecutorial one, but still he does have it within him to react to the atrocities that he's seeing in front of him. And that's being presented as evidence, especially once the court case starts getting going.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking more in terms of like, what is the angle with respect to what is currently happening with Israel and Palestine? And so why is this story being told? What's the PR purpose of this? Well, you know?
And it's Vanderbilt's second film that he's directed, because he's largely only a screenwriter. He did a film, the Dan Rather film with Redford playing Rather, Truth, in 2015. It's Redford and Cate Blanchett.
The timing really seems odd.
The press screening for that. Yeah. Yeah, well, and the timing of that one too, because that one was about the 2004 60 Minutes report into George Bush's military service, and Dan Rather and Mary Mapes, who Blanchett played, and that get fired for it. So 2015 is kind of like start of the journalist distrust being more in the social media mainstream. So that's the rise of Trump there politically. I'm
certainly curious to hear, see a little bit more about that. It was surprising that to see some positive reviews coming out around it, to be honest. So,
yeah, I didn't, cause I saw the trailer before Chloe and I saw the trailer before Smashing Machine. When we were out there for VIF, and I remember googling after and being like, oh, it's not really getting that. Like, there's not a lot of good buzz around this movie. So that's why I watch it with a little bit of a lower bar. And I was also like, fuck, 2.5 hours. Like, I don't really want to, but I had requested the screener, and it was timed. It was only a 48 hour screener or whatever. So I was like, I got to do it. But I'm glad I did in the end. I didn't get that point across. So I enjoyed it.
Miss Melissa, what have you for us, ma'am?
Okay, well.
You've been off, so I'm curious. Have you been watching movies, or have you just been like resting your eyeballs?
I have. No, I haven't been watching that many. I mean, I did the 13-hour movie marathon. Yes, true. Like 12, that's, 12, that's not, 12 that's movies, nothing. You know.
Yeah.
But also, I took my whole family to go see One Battle After Another. So that was
how did that go?
That was interesting.
it's one of those movies, like, even like after Jen and I saw it, I was just like, so what did you think? You know what I mean? Like, I was like so excited. I'm like, I hope you loved it. You know, like it feels like one of those movies to me.
My socialist uncle was not into it. I think it was like just a little too madcap. for him, maybe. I enjoyed it. My mom liked it. Craig liked it. So so there we go. Nice. But yeah, just first of all, one of the greatest car chase sequences in a movie ever.
Yeah.
Like, it's just brilliant. And like, I loved Benicio del Toro in this movie so much. And I loved the, just the concept of the sanctuary city and like all of those politics around undocumented migrants and people trying to protect them and others like trying to arrest them and round them up and deport them while also being dependent upon them for the economy. Like, that was all really clear in this film, I think. And I kind of wanted like, I kind of wanted that to have its own feature. Like, I just found that whole sequence so fascinating. And like, Sensei is a brilliant character. He's so great. Del Toro is so entertaining in this movie. And I think, you know, I just want more on the sanctuary city because I'm like, how do we become a sanctuary city? what do we need to do here? Like, what is there like a kit? Is there a kit that you can send out to people so that they can start their own sanctuary city? Because it looked pretty freaking cool to me. Mm-hmm. So, it's not my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson for sure. But it's pretty great. It's a pretty fun movie. The thing is, I did find at the beginning, the stuff with Presidia, I found like a bit uncomfortable. And I think it's because they're like leaning really heavily into hypersexualization of Black women. And particularly white men's fascination with the hypersexualization of Black women. And so some of that felt really uncomfortable to me. And I was kind of like curious about some of those choices in the film. But aside from that bit, I enjoyed much of the rest of it. And also he criminally underused Regina Hall because she is genius. And like, I don't know, maybe you just can't ever have enough of her. But they definitely did not use her enough in this movie. Yeah, so that's my two cents on One Battle After Another. It gets a thumbs up from me. I also caught up with, mostly because of Marina's review, because I don't know, maybe I would have if I had read something about it, but I think I would have skipped past The Perfect Neighbor just because Netflix true crime is really mostly miss and not much hit. So generally I kind of skip past those, but because Marina had seen it and raved about it and then like finding out about how well it did at Sundance and stuff, this movie's heartbreaking, and really an incredible feat of editing. And just a really, I think like a micro indictment of stand your ground laws. And I think that's really important. Like, I think you can talk about policy. You can have a documentary that sort of deals with policy on a broader scale. But I think having something like this, where you're looking at an individual story and the impact of that story on this family and this community, I think it just somehow like hits harder than something that's broader, that's just talking about statistics. I think this is really powerful, and I think it was just really interesting, and I can't even imagine how many hours of footage they had to go through to kind of boil it down to what this was. And I agree with what Marina had said in the previous episode. Like, this community is like, it's like the dream community, like neighbors who talk to each other, kids who are out playing in the streets, like parents who are watching each other's kids. Like, it just seems like a really like idyllic type of community that it feels like we've moved so far away from now that most people's relationships are kind of online and not physically with their neighbors. It's just sort of like, it like almost doesn't feel real that there's still neighborhoods like that. And then to see something like sort of so traumatic happen in the face of something that I think we all like wish we had. I think makes the film resonate that much harder. So, yeah, Perfect Neighbor. Watch it on Netflix. It is an actual hit for their true crime series. I also caught up with a couple of older movies I hadn't seen in quite a while. So I rewatched Singles, which is very 1992.
Hell yes.
Awesome, really? Banging soundtrack, though. Holy shit.
It has, yeah, the soundtrack is still the best part about it.
And Chris Cornell walking up with the, when they're testing out the stereo in the car. So
he's so hot.
Yeah, Chris, like that's Chris Cornell and Eddie Vedder being in this film is kind of like sweet.
I could do without Eddie Vedder. Chris Cornell is chef's kiss. I miss him. Okay, sorry. Moving on.
But yeah. So yeah, it's so 1992. It's like a weird little time capsule, this movie. Like, it's not the greatest film, but as a time capsule of 1992 and grunge in Seattle, it works, I guess. And it really does have a fantastic soundtrack. I also rewatched Bend It Like Beckham, which holds up brilliantly well. Like, and I have to say, like, Anupam Kher is one of my favorite movie dads of all time. Like, when he kind of does the little speech at the end about, like, how his dreams of playing cricket were kind of shattered when they moved to England, and he doesn't want that for his daughter. Like, it makes me tear up every time I see it. It's I don't know. He's great.
So good.
And the last of my rewatches was Children of Men. Which, again, like, banger. That movie's fucking brilliant. Like, so everything in it hits. Like, the cast is brilliant. The pacing of it is brilliant. The art direction of it is brilliant. And I think, like, in this current climate that we're in politically, it feels like it hits even harder watching it now, because it just feels like this is where we're going. Like, this is where we're going. It's like cages, people in cages, and these crazy border controls, and this like absolute hatred of refugees, despite the fact that everything that we're doing is creating more of them. It's really powerful. It's making me miss Clive Owen a lot too. Cause like, for a while there, that guy was everywhere. Like, he was in every second movie. And then I haven't seen Clive Owen in ages.
He did a couple stupid movies around that time too. Cause he also did Derailed, which is him and Aniston, Mikael Hafstrom. It's a dumb movie, but I really dig that one. The Duplicity with Julia Roberts, done by Tony Gilroy. I like that one. And Shoot 'Em Up. That movie's fun as hell. It's so stupid, but it's so much fun. And Clive Owen's the reason why all those movies are so great. And Sin City was roughly around that time too.
Yeah, and Closer.
Closer is so good.
Closer's so good.
Closer is painful because I really dislike Jude Law in that film. I mean, obviously
you're supposed to.
But like, to the point where it just got under my skin. That movie got under my skin, but Mike Nichols just knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
Very much.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm like, Clive, I don't know where you've gone, but please come back. Mm-hmm. Fun fact, I've seen Clive Owen in person.
Oh shit.
Okay, wait, is he as hot in person as he looks on screen?
Hotter.
He's a good
Yeah. It was so that's weird. I was in Madrid because I was doing like a grad school course in Spain. And it was like my first day in Madrid, and some friends and I were like walking down the street, like trying to find a restaurant to go to. And he like passed us on the sidewalk. Like, he was just like talking to a friend and like passed us on the, and I was like, Oh my God, is that Clive Owen? And none of my classmates knew who he was. And I was like, Oh my God. Like, I wanted to like ditch all my classmates and turn around and follow him. But I was like, what are you going to do? Like, you're going to stalk this poor man. Like, you can't do that. It's just cool that you saw him on the street. So,
funny. I'm just looking to see if I have Children of Men on 4K. Does it exist on 4K? I have a DVD.
I don't think so. Oh, it might actually. Would be through Shout. Might have released it.
I'm gonna spend money, guys. I'm gonna buy that on 4K.
It's worth it. Because
you're talking about it, and I'm like, I need to rewatch this. It's streaming on Netflix, but I feel like I need to put it into like the player. I'm doing this hand motion that nobody else can see. But yeah, I'm looking and I'm like, I only have that on DVD. That's problematic.
It's only on Blu-ray. It was only released. They only had the one release. It was 2009.
All right, so my DVD stays on the shelf.
Yeah, I have it on DVD as well.
Until it's replaced by a 4K. So people, like whoever's got the rights to this thing, we need a better version.
Studios.
That's you guys. Just so brilliant, that movie.
It's so good.
That scene where they're in the car and Julianne Moore like passing the ping pong ball back and forth, like, and then and then she gets shot, like, all of it is just, it's just it's such a good movie. Like, there's just, it's just so layered and so interesting, and every character is fascinating, and it's such a dystopian hellscape.
I don't want to derail this too much, but it's, and I don't even know why it's come to mind, but the last like 3 days, War of the Worlds, the Steven Spielberg version, has been on TV, like basically on rerun and like on repeat, like every time we turn the TV on, it's on. And of course, because that's usually the channel that we left it off of, I've now seen the movie from beginning to end just from turning the TV on. Have people finally come around on the fact that movie is really fucking good?
Hopefully after the terrible Ice Cube one came out. Yeah.
It's really fucking good. I liked it to begin with, but like rewatching it, even in chunks, it's really, really, and really, really dark.
Like, oh, the stuff with Tim Robbins is so
traumatizing.
Well,
even that river scene where Dakota Fanning goes off to pee and she's standing by the river and the bodies start coming down the river and you're like, that's really fucking dark. She's like, what, 8, 9?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, that's not fucking traumatizing for a child. Yeah. No. That movie is really good. Like, I liked it. Yeah. I've always liked it, but I'm like, have we come around on the fact that it's actually really solid? Sorry to derail.
I'm serious. It must have taken the Ice Cube movie because that was so bad.
I refuse to see it.
Don't.
You guys all said it was, I think it was you, Melissa, that said it was terrible. And I'm like, not seeing it.
Don't. Yeah, don't see it. There's no redeeming qualities whatsoever. No. Like, I'm glad Ice Cube got paid, but like, there are no redeeming qualities.
I'm not.
Steve's like, give me back all my money, Dad.
Yeah, exactly. All right, spent it all on Amazon.
Probably. Melissa, anything else?
And then, not a rewatch. I watched Hedda. The new Amazon Prime with Tessa Thompson. This is probably a bit of a niche film, but it really worked for me. I love Hedda Gabler. Like, the Ibsen play is genius. I've seen different versions of Hedda Gabler, and this one is really fascinating. I think Nia DaCosta has done like an incredible job with this film. So it's still set in the same time period, because it kind of has to be, because a lot of this sort of centers around a manuscript, which it's the only copy of the manuscript, which would never happen. Like, you couldn't, modernizing this would require some logistical figuring, I think. So it still takes place in the same time period. But what's interesting is that she's introduced both race and also sexuality in this, because she's kind of queered it a bit. And so I don't know if either of you are familiar with Hedda Gabler, the story, but it's basically a play about a woman who is just hugely manipulative, and sort of has married someone to get status and money, but really was in love with someone else, and that other person moved on. And then it's like kind of all these machinations that she does to kind of ruin their life and in the process kind of her own as well. This movie's gorgeous. Like, first of all, Tessa Thompson is one of the most beautiful women acting in Hollywood these days. The wardrobe for this is gorgeous. Just the color saturation of this, it feels really rich. It's a really, like, it's period piece. It's quite stunning. And I think it's a really interesting retelling of Ibsen's play. I would recommend it, but I also don't know, like, I think this is an example of a very successful transition of a play to a film, because this uses the script of the play, but it reads movie. Like, there's some movies where they try to make a theater piece into a movie and it just feels too theater piecey. This is not that at all. This is like 100% movie. Like, the sets are great. The cinematography is great. There's a lot of movement in this piece. So it never feels like a set piece. Like, you're never stuck in one room. And Tessa Thompson is fantastic in it. I don't know how appealing this is if you're not familiar with Hedda Gabler. If you are familiar with Hedda Gabler, you're going to be super impressed with this interpretation of it, I think.
Add it to the watch list.
So, yeah. So that, and it's streaming on Prime. So if you have Prime, it's easy to find it. Happening. And that wraps it up for me.
An excellent collection of films, people.
Yeah.
All right. What's coming? Bill isn't here to tell us what's coming.
Yeah.
But okay. Steve and I did homework.
Yeah, I'll do my best here. So November 7th, Predator Badlands. Jan Trachtenberg finally getting the big screen to tell a Predator film. This movie looks badass. I'm so excited.
I agree. I think it looks kind of awesome.
Yeah, I have my ticket already, so I'm really excited for that one. I don't know if I'm going to get a screening of this near me, but Die My Love, which is the new Lynn Ramsey film, Jennifer Lawrence and Robert Pattinson. And that
trailer is so crazy, good, but what's better than the trailer is the red carpet looks. Chef's kiss, people. Like, two really hot people in really hot pictures. Just, like, unfair. I will say, Rob looks like he has dead eyes. He's the new face. I don't think he's the new face, but he's the face of Dior Men. And there was, like, a couple of Instagram ads floating around with him looking all dashing in his, like, you know, couture, and it's like they told him to look in the camera and do funny faces, like, you know, you're gonna be sick. I'm like, is this Twilight Days again? Like, you were so much better than this. Like, do not understand, but I will still watch the ads. Thank you very much.
Is it like that scene in Triangle of Sadness?
H&M. Not quite that bad, but yeah, there's like some, like, I guess it's supposed to be smoldering looks into the camera. Mm-hmm. But he is a very handsome man.
Nuremberg, I just talked about that one. That one's out on Friday. Christie finally gets released into theaters on November 7th. Netflix film Train Dreams is getting its theatrical run starting on November 7th. I've heard lots of great stuff about that one, including, I think, Bill said good stuff.
Yeah, Bill loved it.
Yeah, Bill did love it.
The trailer is beautiful.
Yeah, the trailer is really nice. I really like Joel Edgerton.
Me too.
Yeah, me too.
I really like him.
Doesn't The Running Man also open November the 7th?
No, that's on the 14th.
Oh, I'm a week out. All right.
Yeah, so yeah, that, yeah, okay. So I'll say that one. The Running Man is out on November
14th. Melissa got very excited.
I did Kermit flail arms.
Yeah, yeah.
So just picture me doing Kermit flail arms, yeah. Listeners.
So probably recognize that one as going to be our main film for the next one. I don't think Bill will have an issue with that one.
We're all excited about it for different reasons.
For different reasons, yeah, exactly.
Like, you guys are all Edgar Wright. Marina's like, fucking Glenn Powell, man.
Yeah, I know.
I am happy for it for both of those reasons. Yeah. Hence the arm flails.
Do you guys, okay, you know in the trailer where Glenn Powell throws the grenade and then the guy in the balaclava kicks it back?
Yes.
Do you know who the man in the balaclava is?
I'm sure it's some actor. Who is it?
Technically it is an actor. It's Lee Pace.
I mean. Oh, I love it.
Lee Pace. So,
Another man that is
of him.
Oh, he is so fucking hot too. Okay, sorry. We are way off track with the hot men today. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Also, a threequel is out that week. Now You See Me, Now You Don't.
I do not understand how they've made three movies out of this franchise. I don't understand it either. And then everybody is back for this one.
Oh, At least Isla Fisher is back, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
The first one was a lot of fun, though.
It was.
I don't even think I liked the first one, if we're being
honest. I liked the first one quite a bit. Did I see the first one with you, Melissa? I kind of feel like I saw this with somebody from like the old family of nerds. I don't remember. I kind of feel
Was it Sarah? Because I don't remember seeing this in the theater.
It might have been Sarah.
Yeah, that would be my guess.
Yeah. Sorry.
Shout out to Sarah. I don't know if she listens to our podcast.
She should.
Yeah. Listen, shout out. Hey, way to go, Sarah. We appreciate you listening, Sarah, even though you don't. Noah Baumbach's Jay Kelly is getting a release. George Clooney getting some okay press for that one. I heard some okay reviews off of the VIFF screenings for it. But I heard mixed stuff.
Yeah. But can I say like how surprised I've been by like the seemingly rave reviews of Blue Moon?
Yeah, I liked it. Chloe and I both liked it. But, then we saw Nouvelle Vague, and that was the clear winner between the two films.
Yeah, but I'm just surprised that it's hitting, because I was impressed that Ethan Hawke could remember that much dialogue, but it is so fucking dialogue heavy.
Well, it's because Lorenz Hart is the most important man in the room when feels he's better than every man in the room. And so he's going to fill up that room with words. But then when anybody comes in where he knows he's underneath that stature, he's going to be a sycophantic little fucking worm. That's the performance of that film. And he's not going to say that much.
Yeah. I did not find that film that enjoyable, to be totally honest.
That's fair. Keeper. Osgood Perkins.
There.
Yay!
Paulina Maslany, Ross of Sutherland. I don't know if I'm getting this one. Hopefully Elevation will be super nice and hook me up with the screener for that one, because I would love them forever. And lastly, I know Melissa and I have seen this one, and I'm pretty sure Bill's seen this one as well. Joaquin Trier's Sentimental Value is going to be...
And everyone should go see that film, because it is genius.
It's so good. It's so good. I don't think there's a better working humanistic filmmaker than Joaquin is right now. His iron is always so hot.
Also, did you guys read this thing about Stellan Skarsgård so after he suffered a stroke, he hasn't been able to like remember his lines anymore?
Yeah, so they feed
How the fuck did you do that movie when you don't like... It just makes the performance, which is already brilliant, seem that much more brilliant to me, because there's no way you get the sense that this is a man who's having lines fed to him because he can't remember them. And everything about it just feels so it's such an honest performance. I was absolutely blown away when I was reading about that. Mm-hmm. But go see Sentimental Value, because it's really, definitely. Really good.
But that said, Running Man, right?
I think by default it's the one that we can all get to. So it hasn't been on purpose, but my movie credits have been accumulating at Landmark because I haven't gone to the movie theaters in a while. So I have like 5 entries to use up. I'm going to be watching a lot of movies.
Nice.
A lot That's of movies.
Good. That's the good stuff. Movies.
Well, yeah, I would say like Die My Love, if we can all get it. Because for me, like Lynn Ramsey can do no wrong.
I'm with you 150%.
Every single film that she's put out is fucking brilliant. And I'm sure that this will be too. So I absolutely definitely want to see that movie. But Running Man will be easy for all of us to see for sure.
In a perfect world, Die My Love in... a little bit better world, Keeper, but most likely Running Man.
I'm not sure if I can get Dan to dye my love. And if I do, it will be without the trailer.
Well, you and I can go, Marina, because I'm positive I won't be able to get Craig to go see that.
Okay, it's a date. Because I think if Dan sees that trailer, he is definitely out. He's checking out of that one. He'll be like, "What do you? They're running around like dogs. I do not want to see this movie." I traumatized him with one woman turning into a dog movie. I don't think he gets that.
But to be fair, you did traumatize yourself with that movie too.
We all traumatized ourselves with that movie. Let's be honest. All right. Until the next time we get together to record, where can folks find you?
I am at Melzy on Letterboxd, where I don't give star reviews. I either like something or I'm not super fond of it. and I generally write little capsule reviews of things that I've seen. So there you go. Yep. Come follow me if you want.
Exactly. And you can find me on Letterboxd as well at The Marina. I'm still trying to figure out, because I'm now making it a point to check Letterboxd every day, usually in the mornings when I'm having coffee. I'm still not sure which section to read first. So once I have like a rhythm, but I have been better at letterboxing. And Steve, last but not least.
Anywhere that there's a social media, just look up The Steeble Dead and you'll find me. My website is stevestebbing.ca. I do a show on there on YouTube every week with my daughter, Chloe, called What the Hell Should I Watch? It comes out Fridays at 8 a.m. Pacific time. I am also on Tremble the Horror podcast with Kurt and Taylor. Our latest episodes are on Final Destination 2 and 3. And I am also on Shane Hewitt and the Night Shift, which is on Toronto Radio's News Talk 1010 Fridays at 8 p.m. Eastern time on the iHeartRadio network. You can also find that in podcast form wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And I'm also on Kelowna's AM 1150 every Friday, just after the 8:30 news break, on the early edition with Gary Barlow. And I think that's it.
Awesome. Until the next time, you can find links to all the things we talked about today at atcpod.ca. Until then,
hack the planet.
Bye.